A hungry man, another man on the run, and a third who isn't exactly what he seems to be are all that it takes to set the plot of One Man, Two Governors in motion. The comedy had a sold-out run at the National Theatre in London. Now it's transferred to Broadway, where it's playing at the Music Box Theatre on West 45th Street. The production has received 7 Tony nominations, and joining me now are 2 of its stars, James Corden and Jemima Rooper. Welcome to our show.
Hi.
Thank you.
James, you play Francis Henschel, a very hungry young man who's been hired by a man named Roscoe Crabb. What's he been hired to do?
I'm sorry?
What's he been hired?
He's hired as just a general guy to an assistant, I guess.
Yeah. But you say that he's been hired as muscle, and then you point out that
he doesn't have any.
You don't have much muscle.
Yeah. Well, he's been hired to look tough and rough and basically run errands
more than Roscoe Crabb.
Little diminutive.
But is a good meal the main thing on Francis's mind?
Isn't it the main thing on all of our minds? Yeah, a good meal and a nice time with a lady. That's all he really wants and needs. He's very similar to myself.
Now, Jemima, is it a spoiler if I reveal that you play Roscoe Crabb?
I don't know. I don't think it should be a spoiler, though. Apparently, there's quite a few people who are leaving the theatre. Quite surprised that I'm actually a man.
There's a picture of you outside, dressed as a man, with your name underneath.
Yes.
And a big one, yeah. So I don't think it's a spoiler.
So why has Roscoe come to Brighton?
Roscoe's come to Brighton. Well, it's really Rachel Crabb, who is the twin sister of Roscoe Crabb. Roscoe Crabb is dead because Rachel's boyfriend has knifed him. And they've escaped to Brighton to escape the police, having committed this murder. And she's also trying to find her lover, Stanley Stubbers.
And one of the conceits is kind of almost Shakespearean in that you have these twins who look identical, even though one's male and one's female.
Absolutely, yes.
To talk about the plot almost tells the listener that this is a play where the plot is important. It isn't really.
So it's adapted from an 18th century Italian play, The Servant of Two Masters. And then it's been made into some very British kind of thing with a lot of music hall in it.
Nicholas Heitner, the director, commissioned Richard Bean to write a new adaptation of the Goldoni farce. And that's where we decided to set it in Brighton in 1963. And it's kind of end of the pier sort of what you would call music hall, what we would call kind of variety. And they're the same thing, the truth is the play makes no real aspirations to do anything other than just to really make sure you have a really great night.
Would people in a British audience be more aware of that tradition? Americans probably know it best through Benny Hill, but.
Yes,
little else
weirdly,
here.
Weirdly, I think we were very nervous when we came out here. We thought, you know, this all might go for nothing and no one would respond and no one would find anything.
Very funny. I think people laugh at funny.
So many Americans have meetings, but so many Americans have found references that we are obviously doing completely unconsciously, but they keep saying, oh, it's like the Marx Brothers and it's like this and it's like that and there's Chaplin and there's, you know, all those kind of comedic influences. And so people can relate to that, I guess, you know, funny is funny.
And control chaos is always wonderful to watch.
Yeah. And I think there's probably no more greater controlled chaos than what's happening at the Music Box, you know, every night. It's a joy to do, and I think the noise in the theatre is like nothing I think any of us have ever heard. Like the stage door guy at the Music Box, a wonderful man called Tim, who's been working there since 1983. And he said he's never heard. He said he didn't know audiences could be as loud as they are. You know, he never knew.
Is it very different? Is the American audience response very different than the one in Britain?
I'm the straight man, as it were, in the show, and so have like more plot stuff, have more kind of driving. And I found like the minute we got here, the response has kind of been better. Like the audiences listen even more. They respond to some of the nuances than even in the UK. I think there was a kind of not complacency, but just, you know, people in the UK, they sort of, they know James really well. They sort of sit back and go, okay, you know, entertain us. Whereas here, they're so much more sort of like eager and soaking it up more.
There's a love of the theatre in on Broadway, which I think doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, like a respect of it and a want for it to be good. The last time I was here, I was in a play called The History Boys, which we did here, and
which was also a big hit,
and that felt exactly the same in a sense of the warmth of an audience. There's a want for it to be good, and it to be a great night, you know.
And Nicholas Heitner also directed that.
That's right, yeah.
But we associate him mostly with Shakespeare and serious dramas. Does he have this other side that we're unaware of in this country?
Because I think he's like any person who's truly great at what they do. He's kind of limited by nothing. You know, you say that you associate him with that, but then you'd also know that he directed Miss Saigon, and he directed Nice Work If You Can Get It, and he's directed huge comedies at home, London Assurance and things like that, as well as you know, and he's one of the few directors in the world, I would say probably one of only four, who could go from directing Hamlet to directing this to directing, you know, a Greek tragedy like Phaedra. You know, he's one of the greats in that respect.
And now we have Commedia dell'arte in this case. Yeah. But because it's changed so much, the Tony Awards decided not to include it in the revival category.
Yes. I don't know. There was a whole big debate. I think we were sort of warned that it was going to kind of fall short of not fitting either a new play or a revival category, which I
understand to an extent, because, you know, a purist would say it isn't a new play, and a purist would say, well, it isn't a revival. So,
it's a new play. I mean,
of course, it's a new play. I consider it a new play, but it isn't.
So, but if I do a play about a young man, a young woman who come from families that have been at war with each other, but they fall in love. Is that a revival of Romeo and Juliet?
if you were to use the absolute plot points, I mean, and it's so exact to the point where there's even a scene where I have a letter and the letter gets eaten and all of these things, they are exact.
The original, yeah.
They're exact. I mean, throughout rehearsing the play, we would go, well, let's go and look. Any time we hit a wall, we'd go, well, what did Goldoni do? We'd look at the original and go, oh, he just did that. And then we, you know, so I do understand that thing. And I feel like for us to, we have 7 nominations, which is as much as any play on Broadway at the moment. And we're thrilled with that.
My guests are the two of the stars of One Man, Two Governors, James Corden and Jemima Rooper. It's now at the Music Box Theater on West 45th Street. And if you want information about tickets, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. Now, the Goldoni play was set in 1740s Venice. Now it's in Brighton in the early 1960s. Is there something about that period that lends itself to comedy, or is it that Brighton is seen as a funny place by British audiences?
There's all kinds of things.
The traditional of seaside towns in Britain, an end of the pier, suits this play, and I think that the idea of setting it in 1963 was Britain kind of changed a bit around that time.
The Beatles had just come
skiffle along. Bands were just on their way out, and the Beatles and rock and roll was just in its way. And I think it was a time where everyone remembers as being very, very good. I think it was a time where people started to have a bit of money in their pocket, and things started to change a little bit. And I think that's the reason that Nick and Richard decided to set it there.
And the sense of period is reinforced by the music that's performed by a band that's called The Craze. Mm. They sound like old songs. Were they written for the play?
Grant Olding, who wrote the music, his brief from Nick Heitner was to write songs that people think they know. Mm-hmm. And the influences, I think it sort of progresses from starting with sort of skiffle, and there's sort of a bit of Kinks thrown in, and it kind of finishes with kind of Beatles-sounding music. They... the songs are just genius. I think the first time we heard the band in the rehearsal room, I was like, oh, this is going to be really, really fun. It just gets everyone in the mood. It keeps us sane during the show. I never get tired of listening to the songs and singing.
Well, most of the cast was brought over from Britain, but not the band.
Not the band. They're doing it in London still.
Yeah, the songs are the same. And I think the fact that the band are playing when you take your seats, and they play in the interval and they play as you're leaving, and I think it adds to making it all a complete experience in a theatre, you know.
Now, the costumes, I'm assuming, also help you get into the mindset of the time. Mark Thompson has been nominated for Tonys for both his costume design and set design. But, Jemima, does putting on Roscoe's suit help you get into his voice and character as well?
Oh, God, absolutely. I think I spent 6 weeks of pain in the rehearsal room in my own clothes with long hair. I couldn't find it at all. I just felt ridiculous. But, like, I was in a school play, and the minute you kind of put on, and it's a beautiful suit. It was made in London, in Soho, mm-hmm. and by a guy called Chris Kerr, and it's so sharp. It just changes the way you move, changes the way you feel. I have so much fun in that suit.
A comedy can depend a lot on... by the way, the suit that you wear, James, it just looks like almost like... it's hot. Yeah, it's all wool, I assume.
Yeah,
but it really does look like the traditional clown suit.
Yeah, well, I think that those are all nods to... You know, I guess my character in the original Goldoni would have been the Harlequin, and that's why there's the Harlequin socks and the Harlequin tie and things like that, yeah.
Comedy can depend a lot on timing. There's a fair bit of blocking. Was this choreographed like a dance?
Kind of. I guess in the sense of the precision of a dance, yeah. I mean, I think the show's at its very best. I mean, you touched on it earlier. The show's at its very best where in the audience you feel like you're watching complete chaos, and yet what you're actually watching is a group of actors being completely precise on the time and the beats of the whole thing. You know, there's a scene at the end of Act One which is really sort of the play kind of builds towards that moment, and we probably it's probably like a 25 minute scene, and we rehearsed this play for 6.5 weeks, and probably near on 3 weeks of the whole experience were just rehearsing that scene, such is the precision of it.
Because it involves a lot of wordplay.
It's wordplay, and not just wordplay. There's props and the timing, mm. and the timing of doors and when one shuts, another opens, and looks and beats and the audience, and you know, it's.
So should I assume that some of what appear to be ad libs are actually in the script?
Not really. Almost everything that's ad libbed is ad libbed. It just.
But you do a lot of ad libbing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the most sort of interesting thing about the play is that. We've never... Tonight will be our 295th show or something. And
wow.
And yet within that, we've never done the same show twice. Not
yeah.
once. Mm-hmm. Every single night, the audience that are coming to watch the play tonight will be the only people who will see that show. And tomorrow afternoon will be different to tomorrow evening. And I guess my character, I have a certain freedom in that, where I do
to interact with the
yeah,
audience,
and we use the audience in the show, and I think it's a completely unique experience. Certainly, I think for Broadway, I don't know if there's any other play that is doing the sort of things that we do.
Well, they have in the past.
Which productions?
Going all the way back to the 30s, you had Olsen and Johnson going out into the audience and
sure,
doing
but not yeah, but not plays, not a play. I don't know if there's a play which uses the audience in quite the manner that we do. I think absolutely mm-hmm. comedy shows and variety and all of those things and music hall would absolutely do that. But I think a structured sort of straight play, I don't know if that's, you know.
Well, I think that this is part of the theatrical tradition, but you do it so brilliantly, it doesn't really matter. Do you get the laughs in the same places here that you did in London?
There's... yes, there's been like, maybe a few things which we maybe tweaked just because like the slang words or the British slang wouldn't be understood, but really few of those. And actually there's more laughs. There's like some of my favourite jokes, which didn't get much of a reaction in London, now get a reaction, which I love.
And when the audience is really laughing loud, I would think it's infectious. You have to suppress your own laughs.
It makes all the difference. I have to suppress my laughs a lot when James is trying to make me laugh on stage.
I have no idea what you're talking about. But no, it is infectious. It makes it. There are nights. There's nights when the audience. It really feels like the audience is so with the show that you. You think, my gosh. I would do this for free, yeah. You know?
Even though you're tired. On the stage pretty much throughout the whole play, you must leave exhausted.
It's tiring.
A lot of physical comedy, too.
Yeah, well, mentally and physically, yeah, there's a lot of throwing oneself around, but it's... but those nights, that you know, the way it's been here so far, it's never actually tiring while I'm doing it. It's only tiring 5 minutes before... And about a half hour after, you know.
Now, as we pointed out, James worked with Nicholas Heitner before on the History Boys. Jemima, have you ever worked with him before?
I haven't, but doing this show was my third time at the National Theatre. And so I think Nick sort of knew me from the other shows that I'd done there. And the building, I mean, is an incredible place to work. It's so exciting. I didn't go to drama school. I started acting when I was a kid, and so it's been an incredible training for me, and to be sort of accepted into that, under that roof, amongst the other people that work there. And there's so many shows going on. There's usually six shows. You make so many friends. There's no other place like it in London.
Now, this production has received 7 Tony nominations, including Best Director, Best Actor for you, James. Plays won 3 Outer Critics Circle Awards. How many awards in London?
You'd know that better.
I think we won the Evening Standard Best Play. We were nominated, I think, for 4 Olivier's. We won the Critics Circle. Quite a
few. Does that ever get boring, winning all those awards?
No, I think that would
They're
be
piling
a
up.
Tremendously arrogant thing.
And this has an open run?
No, we're here till the end. We're here till September 1st,
yeah.
And then we go home. So, yeah.
So you still have a little time to see One Man, Two Governors. It's at the Music Box Theater at 239 West 45th Street. For information about tickets, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. My great thanks to James Corden and Jemima Rupert for being on our show today.
Thank you so much.